Hello, and welcome to a very special edition of the Reason Roundtable live from Washington, D.C. This is, as always, your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I'm Peter Suderman, and tonight I am joined by my colleagues.
Stop.
No, I'm not going to stop yelling. I'm so excited to be here with Matt Welch, Catherine Mayhew Ward, and Nick Gillespie.
Just imagine that while wearing headphones. And your arm over here, like, toggling the volume knob.
That's... Literally, none of them have to imagine that. They listen to the podcast.
Yeah. So happy Wednesday. And thank you all for braving the Arctic tundra of Washington, D.C. Turns out to be a lot harder in Washington to get ice out in so many ways than you might think. All right, but let's start with some news here. Earlier this week on Dan Bongino's podcast, President Trump called for Republicans to nationalize elections. Yesterday, Trump repeated this claim, saying that states were running corrupt elections and that the federal government should get involved. It's not obvious what this means exactly, but people are understandably taking it to mean some sort of political control over the voting apparatus. It's an argument that this is a prelude to Trumpified partisan election interference. Nick, what do you make of this?
I am against nationalizing elections and nationalizing companies, two things that Trump seems to be hell-bent on. You know, the phrase laboratories of democracy comes from one of the worst dissents in Supreme Court history, where Louis Brandeis was basically saying the state of Oklahoma could run businesses out if they wanted to. But it's a good thing to have 50 different types of election apparatuses in place. I grew up in New Jersey. New Jersey from 1776 until 1807 allowed women to vote, if you can believe it. And that was a good thing.
Did that last?
Yeah. No, they fixed it, and it's all been downhill since then. But we should have more competing models of how to elect people rather than fewer.
Catherine, since you were invoked, I want to sort of expand this just a little bit, right? In some ways, this is the sort of thing that Trump just says. He says a lot of stuff. It's a lot of bluster. And you often just admit, you know, sort of dismiss the nonsense that Trump says. But you combine this with that letter that Pam Bondi sent to Minnesota demanding voter rolls in exchange for pulling back on ICE. Trump's total obsession with Georgia, including the FBI not only searched an election center recently and seized a bunch of ballots, Trump himself reportedly had to have a conversation with the frontline FBI agents about that. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson is bandwagoning here, saying, you know, maybe these states are running bad elections. We don't know. Maybe it's fraudulent. I can't exactly prove it, but it's something we should be concerned about. And you know, there was that whole January 6th thing that people may remember here. So how worried are you? How panicked should people be about this?
I have passed through the veil of worry and emerged on the far side of numbness. And it's wonderful here, guys. And I urge you to join me. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, the Constitution says no to this. Like, the Constitution is really, really clear. We just, like, the federal government does not run elections in this way, and it shan't. And even when the Supreme Court gets up to maximum shenanigans, they are not going to get this one wrong. This is very clear. But Trump will just try 10 different ways. He is obsessed with, you know, election interference, both imagined and perpetrated. And I think our best hope is that he's not going to be on the ballot next time, so he might just stop caring.
Matt, decentralized elections are actually a good way to prevent corruption and fraud, right? Like, what you want is for the states to be running things, not for a big central apparatus, right?
Remember, Nick, like in the 90s when you were in your late 50s?
That's back when my hair was gray.
You've been Benjamin Buttoning this entire time.
I think when we're working on the digital whatever the hell act, the mid-90s, Bill and Hillary Clinton were both talking about the internet kill switch. Yeah. Like, it's always the fantasy of centralizers in sort of would-be democratic world, quasi-authoritarians, to have a simple single switch. And it's the fantasy that it would work. It usually doesn't work at all. And it's a bad fantasy to have to begin with. So yes, of course, you want to have as many different systems as possible. I just find it remarkable that to remember, because it's hard to, you know, with everything that's happened since, that Trump was a steadfast election denier about 2016. Yeah. He spent a lot of time, you're right, sir or madam.
Who won that election again?
He was like, that actually undercounted me by 3 to 5 million votes. He set up a commission with the brilliant Chris Kobach of Nebraska or wherever
he's
from. Kansas. They're all the same. And to look into it, and it went absolutely nowhere. The most distressing part of what happened this week in terms of all this is that Tulsi Gabbard went to Georgia and then like called Trump after. Tulsi Gabbard is the director of national intelligence, and she went to Georgia on this on the ridiculous excursion and then got Trump on the phone like, we totally got the stuff here. What the hell? The fact that the president is doing this, he should be the person who's executing the laws faithfully. Instead, we're doing this. It's dreadful. It's dreadful.
I do want to be clear, the states are bad at running elections, too. I mean, like, let's not get, like, they're laboratories of democracy, but they're, like, the Wuhan lab of democracy.
50 Wuhans, 50 elections. Okay, I think that is a good segue to talk about Trump's first year and what you make of his second term so far. And it's a particularly good setup because something none of you mentioned was that we found out this quote from Trump came on Dan Bongino's podcast. And that is how we get news in Trump's America. Do you guys remember when SEC Chairman Brendan Carr made all of those threats about Jimmy Kimmel and the networks, and it was like, we're gonna, that happened on Benny Johnson's podcast, right? This is the way that news happens in Trump's second term, right?
It sounds like you're jealous.
Yeah. Right? And so, I mean, the Trump administration is government by and for the very online, or as I sometimes like to say, it is government by meme. And so I just actually want to give you a tour of Trump's first year via memes. And let's start with Liberation Day. You guys, like, a lot has happened this year, and a whole lot, but there was a time when Trump imposed tariffs on islands that only have penguins. This actually happened, and then Trump administration officials defended this as a method for gaining leverage in tariff negotiations with other countries. A real thing, and there's a meme about it. Then there was the White House demolition, right? So you can do that because there's no zoning at the White House. This is actually true. So goodbye, Nixon movie theater and the bowling alley. And there's, like, again, the discourse around this, totally crazy, because there were people in the Democratic orbit who were like, this is the main thing that we're going to run on. This is how we're going to beat Trump, is by promising to reverse his ballroom policy. I'm not making this up. I wish I were. And then, of course, Marco Rubio has every single job in the Trump administration and possibly is running several Latin American countries right now. Good for him.
He's here in the audience tonight as well. So that's
very unhappy.
He's actually moderating this podcast. And then we had RFK making whole milk great again. The MAHA movement becomes a got milk ad somehow or another. And this is stuff coming from the official White House account. There's a theory out there that this actually started as a meme ad campaign for raw milk rather than for whole milk. And they realized at the last minute that that wasn't like a thing they could do. And so they just switched it to whole milk. And I kind of believe that. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to go to our last one here. And we are going to skip. We had a whole slide made up for you about the WWE or the Ultimate Fighting Championship. But like, again, there's so many crazy things. We can't cover all of them. But we're back to the penguins. Embrace the penguin. And actually, I got a question for everybody here. I don't know if you can see the penguin meme here. But Trump, tweets, posts this, whatever, embrace the penguin. Do people on this stage know what embrace the penguin means?
It is Werner Herzog originated.
So it originates with Werner Herzog. But I want to read you what a pro-Trump person wrote in a column for Fox News about what this means. Because, again, this is the news environment we are in. You know, the leftists, they don't know how to meme, but the online right saw this meme and they saw something else. Users, mostly male, saw the penguin as a powerful rebuke of secular modernity. They interpreted the penguin not as lost, but as a free thinker.
Well, and they're in a tuxedo, classy, you know.
This is what government in the age of Trump is like. And so I just want to use that as our baseline or setup here to ask our free thinkers on this stage, not about penguins, but about Trump's first term. Two questions for each of you. What do you like the least? And what, if anything, do you like the most besides the penguins? Nick, start.
I will go back to nationalizing industries or companies and things like that. There's many, many things that he's done terrible, but that I feel like that's something that every president going forward and a couple in the past are going to be doing. So that's what I dislike the most. The thing that I like the most is that he shut down the Kennedy Center for at least 2 years. But because he can never let us have nice things, he's promised to reopen it in 2 years.
A 2-year reprieve. Catherine, what about you?
I think the thing I like the least and the most are kind of the same thing, which is, you know, a reason we have always been strongly in favor of the pardon power and presidents using the pardon power more aggressively. You can find for decades going back in our archives, us saying like, pardon everyone, pardon the turkeys, pardon the penguins, probably, because they're free thinkers who are rejecting secular modernity. And
I'm surprised you picked up on that being a woman.
I won't vote on it, don't worry. You know, this is a real monkey's paw situation that we've got here. Like, we should have been careful what we wish for, because Trump has used the pardon power. He has used it very aggressively, sometimes for good, like our pal Russ Ulbricht, who is free, and sometimes for absolutely insane bad, like giant classes of people who are just pals of Trump, everyone who was anywhere near the Capitol on January 6th, including people who were not even involved in any legal proceedings. This is... You know, on the one hand, it is correct to say that people are constantly being drawn into a overzealous, overcriminalized, nightmarish kind of, you know, judicial procedures of all kinds that shouldn't be. And the rule of law is still good and we should try to have it and not just let the president's friends run around and be free.
Matt?
I'm so glad that I went last because, you know, you can just pick whatever they didn't. There's always so many to choose from. I think hiking up the average tariff rate from 3% to 15% and thereby putting to a screeching halt 7+ decades of a America-led geopolitical project to lower trade.
What do you dislike about him?
Yeah, I think that's pretty significant and bad and will have long lasting repercussions, however you say these things.
Reparations
that you can put on a T-shirt that hopefully someone out here is wearing for this event. It is, I think, a bigger deal than our smaller minds can completely wrap around the way that it's going to upend geopolitics in a negative way.
So something that sticks out to me about the Trump administration, the second term here, is just the total abandonment of even the pretense of kind of pretending. Okay, the pretense is pretending, right? But like the pretense of any spending restraint at all, right? So like to the extent that the Trump administration talks about it at all, they do so in a way that's it's not even sort of, oh, you that sounds nice and I wish they'd live up to their ideals. It's just lying. It's just straight up lying. And like, if you go back to the One Big Beautiful Bill, which we have to call the One Big Beautiful Bill for the rest of our lives.
We don't.
Right, the GOP mega bill, right? There's this incredible exchange between a reporter and Carolyn Leavitt, the press secretary. Is the president okay with this bill adding to the deficit? And this was a reasonable question, I think, because absolutely every single credible outside estimate said it was going to add $3 to $4 trillion to the deficit. And Leavitt's response is, this bill does not add to the deficit. In fact, according to the Council of Economic Advisers, this bill will save $1.6 trillion. No, it's not going to save $1.6 trillion. That is not true. Like, they're saying the intention of the bill is to get our fiscal house in order. That is not happening at all. It's just false, like under any definition of these words. Right, we had a $1.78 trillion deficit in 2025. We have $38 trillion in federal debt. No one cares in Washington. No one cares about the big stuff. And also, no one cares about the little stuff. And the little stuff doesn't matter as much, but I do think it's important to check in on some of that every now and then. And so to illustrate that, we are going to play a game, as we sometimes do at these live pods. And this game is called How Much Did That Cost? And the way this game is going to work is I'm going to describe a government spending item. And I'm going to give you a possible price tag. And you just have to decide whether it costs more or less. Right? Is it more or less than the number that I give you? And so the first one of these is, how much did the federal government spend to dose dogs with cocaine? Was it more or less than $4 million? Nick?
It's not enough, however much. I think it is less.
Gather?
I'm like the person that would lose an election because I don't know how much milk costs. Like, I would absolutely be in the checker line being like, oh, look at this conveyor belt you got here. This is amazing technology. So I'm going to lose this game hard is what I'm saying. But in fact, you know what? Let's just say it right now. I'm saying more for all of them. And I feel like that's going to be a good bet. More.
Less, because Catherine's going to be wrong.
So the answer is, in fact, that it cost $5.2 million, not $4 million. It did cost more than $4 million to figure out what happens when you give dogs cocaine. So how much did the federal government spend for
your
researchers?
Dog when you give it cocaine?
That would be a lot, right? Because this dog, it's like a horse.
Yeah. It's a big,
and there's two of them. The vet bills are incredible. Every time you go, the drugs, they cost a whole lot more. This is the libertarian future that we want.
Probably a good point, time to point out, though, that methamphetamine is a better value drug.
Yeah.
It's cheaper and it lasts longer. So, you know, just putting it out.
Libertarians always care about efficiency in everything, as we're finding out. So how much did the federal government spend for researchers to collect saliva samples at EDM clubs in New York City? Was it more or less than $6 million? Nick?
I was part of that study, and I'm going to go with, I'm channeling Lee Majors here, $6 million. I don't think you get out of bed for less than $6 million.
Not
more.
We all know my answer? More.
More.
In fact, it was a little bit less. This one, this is government on the cheap, guys. This government on the cheap, they should have spent more. It was only $2.1 million for saliva samples at EDM clubs. And our final one here, how much should the federal government, this is actually what gave us the idea for this segment, our producers, thank you, Paul. How much did the federal government spend to make Monkeys Play, a Price is Right-inspired video game, more or less than $10 million? And how much are we spending to make you guys do the same thing right now? Nick, more or less than $10 million for Monkey Play Press.
What I want to know is who hosted that.
And how much did they get for Drew Carey? So
yeah, I'm going
to
say more.
Why do you think I yell so much? The monkeys that you have to.
Yeah, more.
More.
Okay, less.
In fact, it was more. It was $14.6 million. $14.6 million.
Right? And the orangutans constantly win. I've seen plenty of.
They actually looked at the research, and this is it's not actually all that valuable, right? I mean, this is I think the point I'm trying to make here is that whether it's Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and defense and the an interest on the debt, which are the big drivers of our budget problem, or whether it's cocaine dogs and monkeys playing Price is Right, nobody cares at any level. There's no spending restraint at all, and we should care about all of it. And that's just, it's an endemic problem in Washington, and since we are in Washington, we are gonna talk about the city and the dire state of urban governance here and elsewhere. I think the inability to clear the snow creech and ice is an obvious symbol of that. But I'd actually like each of you to just sort of pick something here about urban governance here in Washington, D.C., that you want to talk about, that you think sort of represents something that's interesting to libertarians in terms of policy and governance in the city. Nick?
I am going to talk about K-12 education because D.C. is pretty fascinating in that about half of the students in K through 12 education go to some form of charter or school of choice. But the district also spends a huge amount of money, like $30,000 per student, which is very, very high. And the results are kind of good and kind of bad all at the same time. And this is where, in my dotage and my second fatherhood and all of that, I might be getting soft, but it shows that education is just a really tough nut to crack because parents have choice, they're exercising choice, it costs a lot of money, and the results are kind of mediocre. And so maybe we should have fewer kids. Or maybe just I should.
I think that's happening already. Catherine?
I'm just really, really mad that I can't take a robot taxi, and I'm going to rant about it for a little bit. D.C. was one of the first places actually to legalize autonomous cars way back in the day, when it was just a glimmer in Muriel Bowser's eye or whatever. And we are almost 2 years into Waymo's we're looking into it, period. And that is bonkers. And they are saying, oh, we have to do a study, but we can't do the study because there's a budget freeze. And so we'll just have to wait a little longer. You see them sometimes. You see these like sad, like Wally-like Waymos just like roaming around. And they have to have...
There was one on my street today. I was so excited and then not excited.
Yeah, because they are not taking... customers, they are just testing.
So they can kill people, they just can't carry people.
That's right? Yes. Yeah. We are currently in the worst of all worlds. I was in Phoenix a few weeks ago, and I took a Waymo, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I swear to God, second only to my Roomba. I just don't know why people have to be doing these things when robots could be doing them, and DC is going out of its way to make it impossible to clear even the lowest hurdles, despite the fact that the official position of the city is that these things are and can be legal.
It's kind of amazing that Roombas are legal, Matt.
I went back looking in the archives, and the first time that I wrote about the city government of Washington, D.C. showering professional sporting franchises with hundreds of millions of dollars was in 2003. So it's the gift that keeps on giving. The National Stadium, which enjoyed it, we were there, I think, for its opening or somewhere close to that, and saw the first Strasburg game and all that. $440 million that the city government, which obviously has so much money lying around, spent on this, or at least they said they spent on that, then that price tag becomes more like $670 million. The city has a budget these days, about $22 billion. It is finance. It's not a budget item. It's finance. We're just going to increase the business taxes over here. So it's free. Like, we're not taxing people, just the businesses who are paying this tax. It's classic, stupid, giving money from one group and sending it to the next. And what's nice is that enough time has passed that they're now going back and extending the tax to pay for renovations to the stadium that they already built. So it's going to be $200 million more of your tax money, all of you who live in the District of Columbia. And as you all know better than I do, they looked upon all of that and all the other great civic governance that they do here with the snow removal and whatnot, and the rats, and they're like, cool, we're going to give $1 billion for a football stadium so that we can have 15 events a year maximum. It's classic bad government. How do you do bad government? You give all of the money to billionaires, and that's what they're doing. So congratulations to all of you.
Thank you for that, Matt. I know you love Washington, D.C. and are so happy to be here.
I'm really surprised you just didn't go full rats. But I guess you recognize that, like, the pot can't really talk shit to the kettle.
The first column that I wrote after moving here from L.A. was called City of Rats. It's hard to outdo New York, where I live now. And do they still have, like, the DuPont Circle stations are just, like, closed? Because it's like, that's too many rats, man. We can't do that.
If I understand correctly, you voted for the rat killer guy in New York City.
What?
For mayor?
Sliwa is in
Virginia. Oh, Sliwa.
Sorry.
Who was running a campaign and was like, crime is...
He's a lot of things.
Like, mostly just like, what we need is an
elite
hit squad.
I'm thinking about...
You, like, blacked out on that election. You were like, I don't remember anything. I was in an EDM club last night giving saliva samples.
You choose between Cuomo and Mondami. You're going to go with a beret or you're not going to.
I do like a beret.
So I've lived in Washington for over 20 years at this point, with occasional excursions to New York and Boston. It's a great city in a lot of ways, actually. And one of the things that's great about it is that it has a great restaurant and bar scene. In fact, this is one of the best places in the country and maybe even in the world to get a great cocktail. But it's really, really tough right now for restaurateurs. And yet Trump is out there saying things like D.C.'s restaurants are, quote, full and busier than ever. And that's just not true. In fact, last year, a record number of restaurants closed in D.C. And that's due to a lot of factors, right? Jose Andres, who's one of the big restaurant sort of entrepreneurs in the district, has blamed tariffs. He's blamed immigration enforcement, just sort of the general sense of policy uncertainty at the federal and at the local level. But one of the biggest factors that I think people need to focus on here is the change to the tipped wage credit under Initiative 82, right? So as you probably know, most servers and bartenders traditionally are compensated through tips, which can be quite a bit more than you would make from paid wages. But I-82 tried to change that. Over time, the idea was to force restaurant owners to pay servers and bartenders closer to minimum wage. That adds huge labor costs for owners and operators and makes a lot of businesses, especially sort of medium, small businesses, local businesses of the kind that liberals always say they really like, it makes those businesses really, really hard to operate. And in many cases, it also just results in lower pay or a lack of jobs for the people who are servers and bartenders. Now, the D.C. City Council did last year pause the escalation of I-82, so the tipped wage credit, the law didn't go fully into effect. But there is already a push this year to put a $25 an hour minimum wage initiative on the ballot in D.C., and that initiative would also fully phase out the tipped wage credit, so that everybody would have to be paid $25 an hour. If you want to go see some of, I think, Reason's best work over the last year or so, Reason's Justin Zuckerman on our video site put together just a truly outstanding documentary about this. You can watch it online. But the upshot is the workers, the servers themselves, who are making the tips, did not want this. They were opposed to this because there were going to be fewer jobs and they were going to make less money. And it is wrecking DC's excellent bar and restaurant scene. Please remember to tip your servers, folks. So since Matt mentioned stadiums, before we go, I do want to actually talk about something that's coming up in sports news here. We've got the Super Bowl. It's coming this weekend, right?
Are you sure about that?
Sports ball news.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
Well, this is not a sports podcast. Sadly, we don't have that DraftKings
ad. Speak for yourself, pal.
Right. So the Super Bowl is coming up, and it's already being dragged into the culture war, right? You've got this expectation that Bad Bunny, the singer who is going to play the halftime show, is going to say something about immigration. He did at the Grammys last weekend. He had ice out, I think was what he said. You know, we're all Americans, right? This is something that he has talked about quite a bit. And this is already being dragged into the culture war. What do you kind of think about this, Nick? Just sort of the preemptive culture warring of of Bad Bunny and the halftime show before it has even happened.
I love political comments at award shows and things like this, so I'm looking forward to it. I'm just hoping that he sends a fake Indian Native American to sing his songs.
Billy Eilish, hopefully, in that would full be tongue.
But no, you know, I think the Super Bowl, particularly the Super Bowl halftime show, which has come from, some of you may remember the first Super Bowl halftime show, which had a guy in a jetpack, and I think it was Al Hurt playing the kazoo or something like that.
Like marching bands.
Yeah, really up through the 80s. I mean, so I'm looking forward to it. The last couple of...
Catherine, can you summarize anything that's been said so far?
I heard something about marching bands.
Yeah.
And there was a rocket pack?
And rockets. I thought it sounded great.
I flew in on a jetpack. It's like, this will be better than that. And the last couple of halftime shows have been very good. And then if you don't want that, there's the TPUSA halftime show with Kid Rock. Yeah. You know, that you can watch, which Matt's actually
is available.
Matt is now the new hype man for Kid Rock. He's going to be on his
I think
knees,
it emerged with Catholics yeah. for Catholics and just get yeah, like Matt right. Walsh and yeah. Candace Owens to yeah. like.
Do none of you watch the Puppy Bowl?
No.
Matt, all right. So Chuck Klosterman, one of the great Gen X essay writers.
Do you know that he insists on pronouncing it Klosterman?
I did not know.
Oh, I hate that.
Right? Right?
Who is he?
Fuck that.
But this is what makes him one of the great Gen X essay writers. Because if he pronounced it Klosterman, I guess that would be, right? This is what he's like. And he just wrote a book on football. And one of the interesting claims in it is that football is inherently authoritarian. Not just conservative coded, though he says that too, but that it is authoritarian. Do you agree with that? What do you make of it? You hate authoritarians, but you like sports, right?
I don't think he agrees with it, ultimately. I had an opportunity to have a conversation with him recently because he says it's fascist, actually. That's a loaded word in these troubled times. And he's like, do you really think it's fascist?
So that means it's good, right?
Yeah. And he's like, no. His point is more, and his book is interesting, that it is... you know, the players are more interchangeable, that it is really top down. There's no more quarterbacks calling their own plays. They still sort of call audibles. I'm sorry this for all this stuff.
Yeah.
But like, it's not originating from them as it used to with Terry Bradshaw. It's all sort of computerized and people are dispensable. And also it's just very violent and it's a huge spectacle. And I think all of that is kind of true. I still think you're not going to improve on George Will's description in the baseball documentary about Ken Burns. He was sort of slagging it as it has all the problems of American society. It's a bunch of, aggressive violence punctuated by committee meetings. And fair enough. But Klosterman's actual real point, and I think is absolutely true, is that there's never been anything that's been better made for television. Just not. Like, if you look at any year in 2025, I think 90 of the top 100 television shows rated were NFL games. 90. It's just like, that is the last place that Americans not named Catherine Mangu Warden, Peter Suderman, like, gather. And they might even still do it on Super Bowl. You guys might, right? Because it's...
Marching bands. Rockets.
it's a great product. And if you haven't checked into football in a while, just like the pregame shows, the halftime shows, it's nuts. Like military flying everywhere. It's very fun. Yeah.
The military. Excited by it.
Yeah.
I prepared some remarks.
Yeah. I was told that you.
I'm ready. I've already put $10 on Kenneth Walker for the first rushing TD. How did I do?
Can you translate that into?
No, of course not. But I do like sports betting, and it should be legal. Thank you.
All right, that's what I wanted to hear from you, Catherine. No, my question actually for you is about teams, because you don't like sports, you don't watch sports. You are not a regular consumer of sports. And one of the arguments against libertarians, but also an argument that libertarians make against politics is, well, libertarians don't understand that politics is a team sport. And libertarians are like, yeah, we do. And it's bad. And you kind of resemble that remark. That is an attitude that you hold here. So talk about, like, why do libertarians not like teams in politics?
I mean, because both the teams suck, I think. Yeah. Like, I am theoretically open to joining a team that stands for things I believe in and also executes the strategy that it has set out for itself in a competent way without doing regular violations of basic ethical standards. And that doesn't seem like so much to add. And I think that would be true for sports, too. I actually, even despite the, dizzy dame that I am playing up here, did, in fact, attend basically every football game and most hockey games in college. Why? marching band. But
in the marching band, or did
yes,
you
sir.
Like watch?
She wasn't the just in the marching band.
No, I was in college. I was just in the marching band. In high school, I was a drum major.
She was the drum major.
Oh, it's embarrassing. Anyway, the point is,
flautist, right?
I play the flute. Yes, yeah. I do, and wow. the piccolo. Thank you for asking. but I think, you know, at the kind of
on the piccolo.
Don't be rude, young man. At the scale of being kind of loyal to one's own college when they're not very good anyway, you know, I think that's perfectly fine. And same in politics. I think when people are loyal to their small town mayor or whatever, that tends to be perfectly fine. When you have strong views about who should be in charge of the PTA, by all means, carry on. Be as tribalist as you like. But the big teams are also bad in America right now. And there's nothing wrong with loyalty. And there's nothing wrong with even a little silly enthusiasm, but the stakes are kind of real in national politics, and you shouldn't be tribalist.
Matt and Nick, there was a recent report, I think Frank Luntz was involved, on the political leanings of various sports leagues, which, among other things, it sort of found some obvious stuff, right? Like, the NBA is the most liberal. The Major League Baseball.
WNBA, in particular.
Yeah. Yes.
Does that even exist? I've heard of it. I just don't know sports, that's all.
What's the name of the Washington WNBA team?
Didn't you just say it?
Yeah.
That's what we call it here. It's the Washington WNBA team, as far as I can
see. To be fair, a lot of people also don't know the name of our regular football team at this point, so.
NBA is the most liberal. Baseball is the most conservative. But what it found that was interesting was that the independents are the biggest share of NFL players. Independence. You guys wrote a book. What was the title? There was the Declaration of... I think it was the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah.
Does this, like, ring a bell to you? Does this sort of ring true in some way, Matt, Nick?
The great finding from the NFL, things that broke out by position.
I was going to go with that. But.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's 61% of long snappers were Republican. Okay, now I don't want to do a psychosexual reading of this.
A
couple times a game, and you're bending over and presenting rear words. I don't know. I think the Republican Party has a man problem. And I was also disappointed that they didn't do Major League Soccer, because I think that they would have been for forced socialism across the board and probably mandatory homosexual behavior. Because that's what soccer, which I played from 1969 until 1989, basically, we were always being accused of being socialist and homosexual.
I think that's a good transition to our cultural recommendations.
Yeah.
This is a DC-specific episode, and when we do these live shows in cities, we like to make our end-of-show cultural recommendations about the city we are in. And so, in this case, I want you to bring something that is related to the 250th anniversary of America, since we are in the nation's capital. However, there is one proviso here. It cannot be Hamilton. No Hamilton at all. 250th anniversary of America. Cultural recommendation, Nick Gillespie.
So I'm going with an anti-Hamilton piece in part. It's the poet William Carlos Williams in The American Grain, which is a collection of kind of prose poems that he published in 1925, right after immigration was shut down from Europe, certainly in the mid-20s. And it just enlarges what it means to be an American. The first chapter, the first essay is about Eric the Red. And then he goes through different things. Cortez, Columbus are in The American Grain. He makes the case for Aaron Burr, actually. And this, in 1925, it was the first revision of Aaron Burr in American history, you know, since he rightly plugged Hamilton in Weehawken, New Jersey. And it is this sympathetic essay about Burr, and he basically says Hamilton was the great centralizer. Hamilton was the bureaucrat. Hamilton was the lord, the aristocrat, the boss, just a terrible person. And Burr, this horrible person who everybody hated because he was good with the ladies and because he was an individual and he kept going, that Burr is actually the real American out of the founders and things like that. And all of it in The American Grain, there's also great chapters on Edgar Allan Poe. It ends with this beautiful kind of vision of Abraham Lincoln kind of holding the pain of the country together. It's a beautiful book. And again, its function when it was published was to expand what we thought about when we thought about Americans. Because what was going on throughout the early part of the 20th century was as more and more types of people from all over the country, all over the world came to America, the people in power who were reactionary were saying, no, there are only two types of Americans or three types of Americans. There's the Yankee peddler, the Southern cavalier, and you know the mid-Atlantic merchant or something like that. And, you know, and William Carlos Williams was saying, no, there's just something so much more vast and important. We're in that place again. Read In the American Grain and, you know, get into Aaron Burr.
So much depends upon the next answer from Catherine.
I, having been rudely prohibited from talking about Hamilton, will go with actually the next better thing, which is 1776, the musical. I know there's a fan in here somewhere. Let's hear it. Yeah, this is how this city is. And
hot as hell.
This is a fantastic accounting of the American founding. If you know nothing else, if you read nothing else, do not consume, with the exception of Reason's special issue, any of the like 250th anniversary nonsense stuff out there. Just rewatch. Or watch for the first time, 1776, the musical. There's a song about why the turkey should be the national bird. What's that song?
Not the penguin?
Not the penguin, even though he does stand alone against secular modernity. Wonderful John Adams slander, just really, really mean to John Adams. A lot of complaining about the temperature, which is true to the original founding of this country. Lots of complaining about how hot it was. Yeah, just some real bangers. 1776, a musical. Really can't speak highly enough of it.
Matt Welch.
I appreciate you choosing as a category that I've listed a dozen recommendations over the past 15 months on the Reason Roundtable, including one called My American Revolution, a book by Robert Sullivan, which I recommend to everyone for a second time, just because he's kind of a jackass like me who wanders around his neighborhood, which happens to be my neighborhood, and notices like, oh, shit, that was actually an important thing that happened in the revolution, and then uses that as a springboard to himself learn, which I recommend everyone kind of do in their own ways, regardless of where they live, and you will be delighted and shocked and given a sense of wonder of looking into this. The place where I first kind of had that sense of revelation close to where I live, in Brooklyn, New York, there's a park there called Fort Greene Park, not far from downtown Brooklyn. Sits on a hill, and there's a big column on the top of it that no one really ever pays any attention to. And my dad was visiting once, and so, like, you know, you got your dad around, so like, all right, let's go see what the dumb column is about. And the dumb column there is the prison ship martyrs monument. How many people have heard of that? Put a hand up in the air. It's amazing. If you had asked you know, a group like this in Washington, D.C., 100 years ago, you would see 99% people with their hands in the air, because it was actually a source of discussion. More people died on prison ships, British-run British prison ships in Wallabout Bay, which is basically parked off of Brooklyn. A little bit inward from the bridge. More people died in that than they died in the revolution itself in the 7 years of warring. 11,500 is the low number. The high number is 18,000. I knew none of this because I'm a stupid jackass and didn't know. There's this huge column that was put up about, I think, 100 years ago. The disinterred bodies, however you say that, are in a crypt that's been there for a couple of hundred years, and then sort of upgraded, and they have information about all of this, and a poem that Nick told me about tonight, because Nick knows everything somewhere in his brain, but I'm disappointed that he's not going to recite lines from memory, although let's see about how that goes. It's amazing, moving, and you can't believe it. Like, how did I not know this? And part of the reason why you don't know this, or one doesn't know this, is just because everybody kind of moves on. And you know, we have the great friendship with the UK, and let's not go crazy about it. But this was such a huge sticking point between the two countries for centuries. It was an absolute atrocity. They just starved people to death. And then threw them overboard into the water. If you watch any sort of fiction like Turn Washington Spies and some of the other things, you will occasionally see little bits about the prison ships, and they're like these ghastly things. They're more ghastly than one can imagine. So when you're in New York next, if you're in Brooklyn next, go look at it and have your eyes opened to it, and then kind of go down the rabbit hole from there about how that was allowed to happen.
I cannot believe you got through that without saying the words Ken and Burns.
He didn't really dwell on it too much in his documentary.
There we go. That's all I wanted. I just wanted the Ken Burns footnote. Thank you. If we're going to talk about the anniversary of the birthday of America and the founding, I think we have to talk about what powered our founders and the revolution. And I do mean booze. Because there is an absolutely true and confirmed real receipt that was found from a party that George Washington threw at the City Tavern in Philadelphia just a few days before the signing of the Constitution. And on that receipt, what you see is more than 100 bottles of wine, more than 30 bottles of beer, 8 bottles of whiskey, 8 bottles of cider, 7 bowls of punch, and if you've ever made like revolutionary era punch, these things are gigantic and extremely boozy, and that is an inflation-adjusted total of somewhere around $15,000 to $17,000 worth of booze. That is what they drank right before signing the Constitution. Thank goodness. And Washington himself went on very quickly to become one of the nation's greatest and most successful distillers. He had a distillery at Mount Vernon, and there is now today a replica, a recreation, where they are making the same recipe. They found his recipe from the late 1700s, where you can go drink his whiskey, but also which was a rye whiskey, which is interesting because we think of bourbon as being the great American whiskey, but that wasn't true until after Prohibition. Before Prohibition, Americans drank rye whiskey, and that is what George Washington made. That was his recipe. You can also buy his apple brandy and his peach brandy, and those apple brandy and peach brandies are not brandies that are sort of these cheap brandies that have been flavored with fruit that we think of now. They are actually distilled directly from apples and peaches. They're much more like apple and peach whiskey than they are like anything else. And they are delicious. They're just wonderful. And that's what made America, right? And I think, I like, as I have grown older, I have become more bullish on the idea of America and like on what America represents. I think America is the greatest idea in the history of the world. And it probably wouldn't exist without a whole hell of a lot of booze.